Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hillary Shelton of the NAACP, who discusses his group's new report titled Tea Party Nationalism, that examines the Tea Party movement's links with racist and xenophobic organizations. Dan Newman of the group MattBlight.org, who investigates groups funding both sides of California's Proposition 23, designed to overturn the state's groundbreaking Global Warming Solutions Act. And David Moberg of In These Times magazine, who talks about the militancy of French labor unions engaged in strikes against pension reform and the disillusionment of American white workers with the Democratic Party. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A month after his historic election in 2008, Barack Obama faced a fateful decision about his presidency: what to do with his hugely popular grassroots political operation. Some campaign operatives wanted to turn it into an independent organization to push for Obama's change agenda. According to The Nation magazine, an intense debate broke out in the transition team over what to do with Obama's powerful campaign arm. Most insiders resisted the idea of creating an organization outside the control of the White House. Ultimately, former campaign manager David Plouffe won the debate and tossed the online grassroots supporters into a DNC-controlled group called Organizing for America. At the same time, Obama loyalists laid off DNC field organizers hired by former DNC chair Howard Dean to run the Democrats' 50-state strategy, a key element in Obama's victory. Obama's DNC put in its own people that focused more on Obama's agenda and less on party building and voter turnout. This new focus cost the Democrats in the 2009 elections, when core Obama groups, blacks, Latinos, and young people, failed to turn out in large numbers, and Democrats lost key governor races in Virginia and New Jersey. Obama's DNC, run by former Virginia Governor Tom Kaine, ran a highly centralized operation in contrast to Dean's decentralized approach. Under Kaine's tenure, grants to state party committees were cut back, and the local party turnout effort suffered, which may further damage congressional Democrats in the 2010 midterm elections. Former El Salvador leftist guerrilla leader Joaquin Villalobos has emerged as top advisor to conservative Mexican President Felipe Calderón on the drug war that has cost the lives of over 30,000 people. Villalobos, now over 60, has worked for the Mexican government since 2005, before Calderón was elected. The former guerrilla told the Los Angeles Times that the high death rate from drug-related violence reflects the self-destruction of the warring drug cartels. Villalobos adds that the violence will not end until the police force and the judiciary are completely reformed. During the 1980s, Villalobos headed the most combative faction of the FMLN that was feared by the U.S.-backed right-wing government. He also led the move towards peace talks and a treaty in 1992. Former mid-level FMLN commander Hector Ibarra today sees Villalobos as a traitor to the leftist cause. He accuses Villalobos of doing a lot of damage to us. He had much weight and influence, and when he made his turn to the right, it condemned us to orphanhood. Villalobos, with his wife and three sons, left El Salvador in 1996 and moved to Oxford, England, where he earned a degree in political science and launched his new career as a consultant. In addition to Mexico, Villalobos has also been a consultant to Colombia's former president, Alvaro Uribe. The world has grossly underestimated the value of vibrant ecosystems like coral reefs and tropical forests that provide livelihoods for most of the world's poor, concludes a new report from the United Nations titled Global Biodiversity 3. The report, prepared for the annual conference of the Convention on Biodiversity, meeting in late October in Nagoya, Japan, was aimed at reframing the debate over the loss of biodiversity and finding new ways to stem the loss of ecosystems from unchecked development. Across the globe, over 500 million people rely on coral reefs for making a living from fishing and ecotourism, creating a value between $30 billion and $172 billion a year. Warmer and acidic seas as a result of climate change constantly threaten the reefs. The report found that a quarter of all plant species are threatened with extinction, and the population of all vertebrates has been reduced by a third since 1980. According to the Interpress Service, a key question for the conference was how to raise the billions of dollars required to halt the destruction of biodiversity. Currently, $3 billion a year goes to development aid for conservation projects, although the need is 10 to 20 times that amount. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After months of conservative activists brandishing racist signs at anti-Obama Tea Party movement rallies around the country, delegates at last summer's NAACP convention unanimously passed a resolution condemning white supremacist elements within the Tea Party and called on the group's leaders to repudiate members who spread a message of bigotry and hate. When Congress passed the health care reform bill in March, Tea Party activists protested on Capitol Hill, with some hurling racist epithets and even spitting at members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Although Mark Williams, president of the Tea Party Express, was expelled from the group for his racially offensive remarks, the movement as a whole took on a defensive posture against charges that some members too often tolerated racism and anti-Semitism. On October 20th, the NAACP released a report titled Tea Party Nationalism that was produced by the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. The report details more than a dozen examples of hate group leaders who currently head various Tea Party factions. Among individual Tea Party activists profiled are individuals with links to the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, Christian nationalist militia groups, and the Council of Conservative Citizens, the direct successor of the White Citizens' Councils of the Old South. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hillary Shelton, the NAACP's Washington Bureau Director and Senior Vice President for Policy and Advocacy. He summarizes the findings of the Tea Party Nationalism Report and discusses his concern that the Republican Party has not distanced itself from some of the Tea Party's xenophobic and hate-filled rhetoric.
We believe the vast majority of those who joined the Tea Party joined because they were looking for a political outlet that wasn't being provided to them by either the Democratic or Republican parties. That they believed that in many cases, and we've seen this happen in some elections across the country, that quite frankly, as kind of right-wing as their ideologies are, even the Republican Party wasn't really meeting their issues and concerns. Our research shows us that because of this very loose construct that is the Tea Party, they often talk about themselves as not an organization with a constitution and a structure and a defined membership capacity, but as a movement which anyone can join. If you pretty much believe in their two basic tenets, you too are Tea Party. And those issues are, if you believe that the government is too big or that taxes are too high, then the Tea Party is the place for you. Well, the problem is, with that loose construct, it also provides a very fertile ground for racists and other extremists to actually bring their agenda in. As a matter of fact, even as we pointed out in the report, even David Duke, of course, a former Grand Dragon of the Klan, a politician in Louisiana, and a member of the Nazi Party, has said very loudly and clearly that he sees the Tea Party as really an organization that's just made for people like him. In essence, because of that construct, it makes it a lot easier for those with more insidious agendas to utilize that loose structure to begin injecting their vile venom of racism and intolerance.
Have any of the people that you've cited in this report been terminated? Have they been fired now that this is nationally documented in terms of their racist and extremist views and organizational connections? Have they walked away or been forced to walk away from the Tea Party movement?
We've not heard of any such thing. Part of the challenge is there's not much of a structure that could actually push them out if they wanted to. And whether or not they're being involved in some of the Tea Party Federation meetings, as you know, one of the places those six constructs meet is at the Federation meetings, we haven't heard of any of the members of any of these extremist groups being kicked out there, nor have we heard of anyone actually tendering a resignation to that end.
I wanted to ask you about the Republican Party and their embrace of the Tea Party and your concerns about the racist elements that exist within this loose coalition of Tea Party groups and what it says about the Republicans. Certainly they've had a history of what's been called in the past the Southern strategy, playing on white voters' fears and prejudices to get votes at election time. With a lot of the railing against Muslims and Latinos we see in the current campaign, mostly by Republican candidates, it does seem an echo of that old Southern strategy, does it not?
Well, in many ways, it does remind us of that. In some ways, it's really unfortunate that we're seeing almost no consideration for those racist elements that we've actually uncovered within the Tea Party itself. And certainly we understand the Republican Party wanting to make sure they build coalitions that allowed them to be successful in the November 2nd election. And we understand what it's like to be the minority and to actually seek power in a situation like this. But it does raise concerns that there's no discussion about these outside elements. The fear is that since you have this element that's also proven to be a segregationist, racist, and sometimes violent element, and if the experiences we saw in August prior to the vote on the health care bill, and even prior to that when members of Congress went back to talk about that health care bill and had their meetings disrupted, if it's anything like what we saw happening to people like John Lewis, Emmanuel Cleaver, Barney Frank, when they went across the street as a Tea Party rally occurred on the west steps of the Capitol, as some of those involved in that rally went over to the east side and began calling them names and spat on Emmanuel Cleaver. If that's any indication of what we're to expect from this wing, or our friend David Scott, another member of the Congressional Black Caucus in Georgia, whose office was painted on the side with a huge swastika, and other members of Congress who were from the more progressive caucuses within, whose offices had rocks and bricks thrown through the doors and windows. If that's any indication of what we're to expect from this element of the Tea Party to be, being actively involved in the Republican Party, we have a real problem on our hands, and we have to do everything we can to address it right away.
To my knowledge, the Republican Party has not publicly denounced the racist and xenophobic elements within the Tea Party, or have they? How has the Republican Party responded, in your view, to what you and others have pointed out, to the troubling connections with Tea Party activists?
We haven't seen a response from the former Republican Party one way or another on that particular element. As a matter of fact, the last we heard from the Republican Party was Michael Steele, saying that he welcomed the Tea Party into the Republican Party and said that there were no disagreements between the two entities and that he looked forward to working with them to bring victory to the Republican Party in the November election.
That was Hillary Shelton, the NAACP's Washington Bureau Director and Senior Vice President for Policy and Advocacy. Download a copy of the Tea Party Nationalism Report at teapartynationalism.com or call the NAACP at area code 202-463-2940. In 2006, California passed a groundbreaking law to address climate change, known as AB 32, or the Global Warming Solutions Act. In the face of inaction by the federal government on climate change, this state law requires California to reduce its global warming emissions, including carbon dioxide and five other gases, to 1990 levels by 2020. That would be a 25% reduction over current levels and would put California in compliance with requirements specified in the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, which the U.S. never ratified. Proposition 23 on the ballot in California this November is a referendum question backed by big oil companies designed to overturn the Global Warming Solutions Act. If approved by voters, Proposition 23 would suspend implementation of AB 32 until the state's unemployment rate drops below 5.5% for one full year, something that has rarely happened. The state's current unemployment rate is now 12%. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dan Newman, co-founder and director of MapLight.org, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization that provides citizens and journalists transparency tools to shine a light on the influence of money in politics. Here, he talks about the millions of dollars being poured into the campaign by both sides and what polling shows about where voters stand before Election Day.
In support of 23, we've got $10 million raised so far. Overwhelmingly, two-thirds of that money coming from just two oil refinery companies, Valero Services and Tesoro Companies. Those are both Texas-based companies. Valero gave $5 million and Tesoro's given $2 million, with the most recent contribution coming from Valero, $1 million on Friday.
I'm sure you there in California have been inundated by ads both for and against Prop 23, right?
Well, I'll read to you some information here that from the Yes on 23 arguments. Yes on 23 saves jobs, prevents energy tax increases, and helps families while preserving California's clean air and water laws. California can't afford self-imposed energy costs that don't reduce global warming. 2.3 million Californians are unemployed. Proposition 23 will save over a million jobs that will otherwise be destroyed. So that's the yes side. The no side says Texas oil companies designed Prop 23 to kill clean energy and air pollution standards in California. 23 threatens public health with more air pollution, increases dependence on costly oil, and kills competition from job-creating California wind and solar companies. American Lung Association in California, California professional firefighters say no on 23.
So there's big bucks on the pro-Prop 23 side, which is to say the side that would gut AB 32, California's global solutions law. But hasn't even more money been raised on the other side, the side that wants to keep the law in place?
There's three times more money on the opposition side. That's $30 million. The number one contributor is Thomas Steyer, who's a hedge fund manager. Number two is the National Wildlife Federation, $3 million. And the characteristics are different. In opposition to Prop 23, you've got roughly eight people who've given $1 million or more. You have some well-known names like Bill Gates, who's given $700,000, James Cameron, who's the director of Avatar, $1 million. And you've got those couple of environmental groups I mentioned, National Wildlife Foundation, also the Legal Conservation Voters.
Dan Newman, are there just regular people donating to one side or the other?
There are. We don't have statistics on exactly how many. We do know that there are contributions come in, at least on the opposition side, from across the country of under $1,000. I mean, from a numbers point of view, those small contributions are tend to be insignificant when you look at, you know, where the bulk of the money comes from.
Is anybody able to evaluate these claims? To say that if you don't implement AB 32, you will clean up the air seems a little disingenuous.
Well, there is intense interest in this, both in the state and nationwide, and there's a lot of good news reporting on what the effects will be. I mean, no one knows for sure, of course. AB 32, which is the law that Proposition 23 would repeal, is a groundbreaking law, and it was implemented in part because of the federal government's failure to act on climate change issues. And so it's kind of a public policy that's new that people expect to have a big effect. But as far as predicting the outcome, I think if you ask each side, you get a very different picture.
Do you get a sense that many Californians are upset that almost all the money to support Prop 23 is coming from out of state and from dirty energy companies?
The fact that most of the Prop 23 money is coming from Texas-based companies, the no on 23 side has been making a big deal out of this. You see signs around here that says no on Texas oil, but no on 23. However, I think these companies have an economic interest that goes far beyond their state. I mean, Valero is a, you know, multi-state refining organization, and so the fact that headquarters in Texas, I think, is being used against them politically. However, I think many large corporate contributors to ballot initiatives in California are multi-state organizations, and you know, just because they're headquartered in a state doesn't change the fact that they have economic interests all over.
I've read about it way over here in Connecticut, but on the ground there, are pollsters predicting a close vote?
A poll released Monday by the Los Angeles Times and the University of Southern California said that among likely voters, this poll says that 48% reject Proposition 23, and only a third or 32%, mostly Republicans, favor a suspension, which would be a yes vote on 23. I do think it's interesting that on Friday, Valero Services Incorporated put in another $1 million into the ballot measure. The day before, last Thursday, Tesoro put in another $500,000. So I have to think that based on that, it may be a closer election than that poll indicates, because just the fact that these companies have recently been putting in money, they're in a position to know what the polling data shows, suggests that they see some value to putting more money in.
That was Dan Newman, co-founder and director of MapLight.org. For up-to-date information on Proposition 23 and other election campaigns they're watching, visit their website or call the group's Berkeley, California office at area code 510-868-0894. Over the past 2 weeks, French workers have engaged in militant national strikes and massive protests in opposition to President Nicolas Sarkozy's plan to raise the minimum retirement age from 60 to 62 and the age for a full government pension from 65 to 67 years. Although there is widespread public opposition, the French Senate and National Assembly have passed different versions of Sarkozy's pension reform bill and are expected to finalize and approve the law. Millions of workers were joined by students in recent street demonstrations, with more planned. Strikes and blockades at fuel depots and refineries have caused gasoline shortages, while some fringe groups have broken shop windows and overturned cars. But despite the disruption, polls have found that nearly 70% of the French people support the strikers and oppose Sarkozy's pension overhaul. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Moberg, senior editor with In These Times magazine, who discusses the militancy of French labor unions and why U.S. workers have for many decades rejected more confrontational tactics to oppose anti-worker policies. He also explains why a growing number of American white workers are disillusioned with the Democratic Party going into the November 2nd midterm congressional election.
One of the things that was striking both back in 1968 and now is the way students and workers often join in together in these protests and strikes that occur. It was more initiated by unions in this particular case, with the rise in pension age being proposed. And students initially took the lead in 1968. And in many cases, and I think both of these instances, there's a combination of the specific grievance and a more general protest against the direction of the government overall. You know, it's quite striking. It's almost rare to find in any public opinion polling where 70% or more of the population agrees with a particular position, particularly when it's a highly controversial one. But polls seem to indicate more than 70% of French people backing the protesters in their current demonstrations.
David, it's interesting that in France, as well as in Greece, in Spain, and other European countries, there is militant resistance underway to the proposed austerity measures of these governments throughout the European continent, and a coalition of workers European-wide that are opposed to this. Here in this country, it seems you've got some activism, but it's on the right, and people here are demanding austerity. Workers have been pretty quiet in this country, and although I know there was a demonstration in Washington, D.C. not that long ago of unions, it wasn't explicitly opposed to austerity, and the articulation of the complaints of workers in this very dire economic time have not been very apparent or clear.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the problems in this country is, among many others in our political culture, is a kind of selfish individualism and a lack of solidarity. Solidarity, you know, it's not just a question of compassion for somebody else who's having a hard time, but realizing, you know, that a large number of people, in this case, most workers, are in the same boat. And one of the things that almost everybody would recognize is the importance of having health insurance. And yet our political culture ends up getting divided between people who have health insurance and people who don't have it. The people who do have it seem to, in many cases, be willing to protect what they have, even though what they have may be vulnerable, rather than shift to some kind of system, you know, that would guarantee health insurance for everyone. And it's, you know, similar kind of situation that shows up in terms of people wanting to save their jobs and protect their jobs, but being unwilling to take action that would protect jobs of other people. So there's this lack of solidarity, or, you know, put it in other terms, kind of a lack of consciousness of being of the same social class, of having the same kind of problems, that makes for a big difference in terms of how people respond. So, for example, you know, young people in France end up seeing a self-interest as well as a concern for parents or grandparents in this pension issue. The self-interest that they see is that if workers have to work longer periods of time, that it may cut back on the openings of job opportunities for young people. So they see a common interest rather than being pitted against each other. I think that one of the most important distinctions between the kind of political culture in France and in this country.
And David, in your recent article, Wooing the White Working Class, you discuss how many working people that you interviewed in Ohio and certainly all across the country are disaffected with the Democrats. They think they're too cozy with Wall Street. Tell us a little bit about the reasons you heard people were upset with Obama and the Democrats.
Well, I think that the main theme that caught this kind of sense of disillusionment is a sense that not much has been done for what people call the middle class, or what others might call the working class, or working class and middle class. People look at what's going on and they think, well, banks are getting lots of money and they're not being asked to do much of anything for it, and GM's getting lots of money, and everybody seems to be getting a bailout but me. So there's simply not that much that many people see as being delivered to them. You know, they've gone through a decade in which their real income actually shrank for the most part, where unemployment has hit them hard, and disproportionately unemployment has affected working class men. And this discontent that we see politically with the Democrats is also disproportionately concentrated among men, and white men at that.
That was David Moberg, senior editor with the Chicago-based weekly publication In These Times. Read Moberg's columns online at inthesetimes.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446. Or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.